Not quite war in eastern Ukraine. Today, Monday, April 14th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Tensions rise further in eastern Ukraine as pro-Russian militants dig in their heels. This analyst says fears of war are not overblown.
What I see in the near future is at least a 50-50 chance that Russian troops cross the border into Ukraine.
Also today, parsing the root meaning of the word for pregnant in different languages, including Russian.
It has this kind of almost quasi-religious meaning of burden, of punishment. You're carrying your burden.
Plus, wooing Hispanics to be climate change activists as the sea level rises around Miami.
We have to get the entire population moving. Right now, if you look at it, 65% of this county is from Hispanic descent.
Those stories after the news.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. There's a lot riding on what happens next in eastern Ukraine. The future of U.S.-Russian relations, for one. Washington and other Western governments accuse Russia of being behind the unrest. They point to pro-Russia militants in the region wearing uniforms that look like Russian military uniforms, minus the insignia, and carrying specialized Russian weapons. More than a half dozen towns and cities around the key eastern Ukrainian province of Donetsk appear to be under the control of these pro-Russian gunmen. Max Seddon is foreign affairs reporter with BuzzFeed. He's in eastern Ukraine. Max, tell us where you are now, where you've been, and what you've been seeing.
I'm in Donetsk right now, which is the provincial capital of the key province in eastern Ukraine that has been the center of unrest over the weekend since anti-government protesters seized government buildings. Some of them are armed. There's a lot of evidence that they have been helped by professional special forces people who have since melted away. The Ukrainian government and Western diplomats suspect that Russia has had a hand in planning all this. And the upshot is that the central government in Kiev has effectively lost control over this province in the east.
So are these clashes indicative then that Ukraine's central government in Kiev really has little influence over which way Russia decides to take the story?
As far as what Kiev can do about Russia, it seems to be basically nothing. When you announce, as President Turchynov did last night, an anti-terrorism operation in the east of your country to take back these buildings, and then about 12 hours later, you're on the phone to Ban Ki-moon of the UN asking for them to send peacekeepers, it's a clear admission of failure. And they might as well just deal with the European Union and say that they're gravely concerned and not do anything serious about it.
As you've been moving around the province of Donetsk, have you witnessed any of the violence we've been hearing about?
I have. I was in a place called Khorlovka. It's about 45 kilometers outside Donetsk. It was the last major town in the province that had not had a major building occupied, and the police were trying to hold out against a mob here. And unlike some other places where there's a lot of evidence that special forces, possibly Russian, who knows, that's not what happened in Khorlovka. You just had an angry mob that went and barged in, beat up some of the cops, and it was very ugly. A British photojournalist, Frederick Paxson, who is here for Vice News, was assaulted, and they roughed up his camera. He's fine, but it was a pretty scary thing. There was a lot of hostility towards foreigners there. It was an unruly, angry mob.
Right. So Anders Fogh Rasmussen, the Secretary General of NATO, says he's very worried by the presence of what he calls men with specialized Russian weapons and identical uniforms without insignia. He seems to be suggesting they're professional Russian soldiers there in eastern Ukraine. Have you seen any evidence of that?
I have not seen any of them myself. There are some videos and photos you can see on the internet where these men, they're called the Green Men, because in Crimea they appeared out of nowhere and they wouldn't tell you where they were from. So they are definitely there, but there isn't really the need for some sort of massive Russian special operation. You do not need to send in the tanks when your opponent can't even muster the cops. I haven't seen a single representative, apart from traffic police, of the central Kiev government for the last 2.5 days. And until they can get that together, then they really don't have a chance of taking anything back.
Max Seddon of BuzzFeed speaking with us from eastern Ukraine. Thanks very much, Max. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
To better understand what's happening in eastern Ukraine, it helps to know what the region was like before the current crisis. Daniel Dresner lived in the city of Donetsk back in the 1990s. He's a professor of international politics at Tufts University's Fletcher School of International Law and Diplomacy. He describes Donetsk this way.
Imagine the worst aspects of Detroit and Pittsburgh and then eliminate all advertising whatsoever, at least when I was living there. But it was a coal and steel mining town. And the important thing to realize is that everyone spoke Russian.
And why is that important?
Well, everyone thinks of Ukraine as being an independent country, and it's no doubt that that's true. But particularly in eastern Ukraine, the lingua franca was Russian. And the identity of the people when I was there in the mid-90s – now, bear in mind this is more than 20 years ago – but the identity of the people there I would describe as almost Soviet. They didn't necessarily see themselves as Ukrainians. They saw themselves as sort of ex-Soviet.
So since you lived there, I'm just curious to know if you ever expected it to one day becoming a flashpoint in what looks like, well, there has been some armed confrontation.
I can't say that I did expect that. While there was no doubt that the identity of the Donetsk residents were Russian, they also weren't exactly the most politically active of people. And they had very good reason to be. I remember once going down into a coal mine in Donetsk. And remember, this is the primary industry of Donetsk at that point. And the environmental and safety conditions were just deplorable. But really, the miners just sort of treated it as part of their daily business. So if they were tolerant of the mines, there didn't seem to be any evidence that there was going to be any kind of sign of political activism.
How do you explain what's happening right now in Ukraine to your students there at Tufts?
What I explain is that Putin has made clear what his calculation is, which is that he prefers the idea of territorial annexation at this point to any kind of economic benefits he thinks he's going to get from long-term engagement with the West, or he's gambling that Western Europe is so dependent on Russia for gas that he can get away with these moves right now and not suffer any of the consequences. And domestically, it's worked for him incredibly well. He's bolstered his domestic popularity. The question is whether things will continue to be popular a year from now.
So how worried should we be about all-out war in eastern Ukraine?
We should be somewhat worried. The odds are that the Russians might decide to go in. If they go in, the Ukrainians will definitely fight back. So there will actually be a conflict. The question is how sustained it'll be, in the sense of Russia's military forces probably are far superior to Ukraine's military forces. So in all likelihood, they would win, at least in eastern Ukraine. The key question is how far west would Russia want to go? Would they want to seize more of Ukraine? The further west they go, the more resistance they are going to encounter, not just from Ukraine's army, but from the population. And that could be too much for them to swallow. The other possibility is that what Putin does in eastern Ukraine is similar to what he did in Georgia in 2008, which is he doesn't annex the territory. Rather, he tries to create autonomous republics that he essentially controls.
So what do you see in the near future? And if you were living there again, what would make you most nervous right now, Daniel?
What I see in the near future is at least a 50-50 chance that Russian troops cross the border into Ukraine. And I think what makes me nervous is the fact, as I said, when I was living there, you never saw any kind of sort of violent political activity like this. There was a general acceptance of we're living in Ukraine now. The fact that you actually have this kind of violence going on in Donetsk, going on in other eastern Ukrainian cities, whether or not it's being propagated by Russians sort of pretending to be Ukrainians or not, it's a sign that the situation is incredibly volatile.
Daniel Dresner at Tufts University's Fletcher School, thanks very much.
Thank you.
By the way, the White House says it's very concerned about Russia's provocative actions in this crisis. Those comments coming as more details emerge about an incident over the weekend when a Russian military jet repeatedly buzzed a U.S. Navy ship in the Black Sea. So that volatility we just heard about, not confined to eastern Ukraine. To hear how things look like from Russia, we reached New York Times reporter David Hershenhorn in Moscow.
The interesting thing is that we have this ongoing unrest throughout eastern Ukraine. These are pro-Russian demonstrators who are demanding protection. They would like to see Russian troops come in and keep the peace. But it's important to remember that there was no threat to peace before these violent demonstrations started. So they're effectively asking either for President Putin and Russian forces to protect them from themselves or to protect them from some sort of imaginary threat from Kiev that we just haven't seen yet. this idea that from Western Ukraine, they would see fascist invaders of some sort coming to oppress Russian speakers in the East. President Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, said today that he's receiving numerous requests for assistance from Eastern Ukraine, that the president is watching these developments with great concern. I think everybody in the world has concern over unrest in Eastern Ukraine. The big question is, at what point, if ever, does Russia go in with military force?
What does that mean exactly? Great concern in Moscow. Does that make intervention more likely?
You know, it seems to just perpetuate the status quo. There are very important negotiations coming up in Geneva on Thursday, four-way talks. This would be the first time that would put the new Ukrainian government, Russia, the United States, and the European Union at the same table. What is different is that the central Ukrainian government in Kiev has threatened to begin an anti-terrorist operation to bring in the military. It's not clear that they have those capabilities. They've threatened that. If they do make that kind of a move, it could provide the pretext that Russia seems to be looking for to send in its own troops across the border to protect the people that it says have a right to be demonstrating and seizing these buildings in opposition to the government in Kiev.
David, you've written about a xenophobic chill descending on Moscow. What is the mood there right now? I mean, do Russians have the stomach for another intervention somewhere?
Well, Russians are generally quite supportive of the annexation of Crimea. That part of it, there's no question, has a lot of public support. I spent quite a lot of time in Ukraine and Crimea. I was out of Moscow for quite some time and came back to find a very different city. This is a city that is much more attuned now to the ongoing conflict between Russia and the West. We've seen Russian flags in places where they hadn't been before. But even more interesting and unsettling have been the effort to focus in on so-called traitors within Russia itself. This banner was unfurled outside Dom Kinigi, one of the largest bookstores in Moscow, showing five well-known political opposition figures and two space aliens, you know, basically referring to the traitors among us. There's now a traitors.net website where patriotic Russians can suggest a traitor to be added to the site, to be photographed there and described why they are undermining Russia's interests. This, in addition to heightened anti-Western, anti-American sentiment, which I think everybody feels throughout this city.
What's it like being an American journalist in Moscow right now?
Well, you know, we continue to work as we always have, but you do get the sense that when you're speaking English around town, people do notice it a bit more. There's no question that the effort to suppress speech and control the press has been underway for quite some time. There's been some acceleration of that in recent days. This ongoing effort to really bring a chill on opposition speech, to stir Russian nationalism and Russian pride. It's a dangerous game, of course, because Russia, in fact, is quite a pluralistic country, many different ethnicities and languages spoken throughout the Russian Federation. So it's a dangerous game to continue to stoke these nationalist feelings. So this, you know, xenophobic chill, as we've described it, is quite unsettling.
Also, I gather Captain America, the Winter Soldier, has just opened in Moscow. That's ironic.
It was number one at the box office on the weekend that it opened, and folks continue to head to the movies as they do all over the world. It's a disconnect between, you know, what's seen as a political flap, a political disagreement, and the cultural affinity that people now feel is universal and international all over the world, for whether it's for superheroes or anything else.
The New York Times, David Hirschenhorn in Moscow. Thanks very much.
Sure thing. Thank you.
Later in the program, we dig into the latest report from the United Nations Climate Change Panel. In the past, the panel has warned of the very dire consequences of climate change if nothing is done to stop it. Now the UN experts are saying we can do something about it, and the cost of it could be relatively modest, but only if the world acts quickly. Digesting the UN's report on measures to fight climate change, that's coming up in just a few minutes here on The World. This is PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. What's in a word? A lot, if the word happens to be pregnant, as in with child. But the state of being pregnant means different things depending where you go. In some countries, it's a cause for public celebration. In others, it's a private matter that's embarrassing to discuss openly. We've been exploring issues surrounding pregnancy and childbirth in our ongoing series called The Ninth Month. And it got us wondering, what do the words people use to describe pregnancy in a given language say about the society's attitudes toward pregnancy? Logically, it would seem there's something to that. So we put that question to the world's language editor, Patrick Cox, and here's what he learned.
The most commonly used word for pregnant in Russian is
беременная.
Now, that only means pregnant figuratively. The literal meaning of the word is quite different.
It has this kind of almost quasi-religious meaning of burden or punishment. You're carrying your burden.
That's Svetlana Boym, by the way, a professor of Slavic and comparative literature at Harvard. And it's not just Russian. Words for pregnant in several other Slavic languages have the same root meaning of burden. Makes you think, how exactly do people in the Slavic world view pregnancy? And how exactly do speakers of the Chichewa language in the African nation of Malawi view it?
Pakati and matenda.
These two words for pregnancy both convey sickness, says Malawian journalist Ivoni Sundu. In fact, the literal meaning of the first word, pakati, is between life and death. Sundu told me about a third word for pregnant in Chichewa, wodwala. Its root meaning?
It's not all that different. Wodwala, it means somebody who is sick.
Three words, the only three words in Chichewa to describe pregnancy, and they all link the condition to sickness. Here's one way of describing pregnant in Chinese.
Youxi.
Wenjing Li is a Chinese teacher here in Boston. She says Youxi is made up of two Chinese characters.
Youxi means have happiness.
Yo means have, Xi means happiness. Put them together and they mean pregnant. Now these three languages aren't outliers. Translate pregnant into many other languages and you'll get words that break down into all kinds of meanings. The Spanish word for pregnant, embarazada, is often confused with the English word embarrassed. They may have different meanings today, but the two words come from the same root. The word for pregnant in the Amazonian tribal language of Piraha is kuhiaga, which means stomach. Now to us, that may sound vague, but when the Piraha say her stomach is big, it means only one thing. All these words and all these meanings, they're rich with cultural information. It makes sense that the Chinese, with their Confucian values, would view pregnancy as a happy circumstance, just as it's not surprising that Russians, with all the suffering in their society, would view pregnancy as a burden. And in a poor country like Malawi, where women may not be able to get adequate prenatal care, you can see how pregnancy might be viewed as sickness. It stands to reason that we should mine these words for clues about the behavior and views of the people who use them, right?
It's really tempting to think that the different words that we often use has something to do with the culture that a language corresponds to. But actually, there's a lot less to ideas like that than we like to think.
This is linguist John McWhorter of Columbia University, here to reluctantly burst a popular bubble.
It's a shame. I know how attractive it seems because I've been there.
Okay, so what is going on when the literal meaning of a word takes off in so many different semantic directions from one language to the next? And why shouldn't we think that it tells us something about other cultures? Back to the word in question, the English word.
Pregnant. You know, what actually does that word mean?
Well, look in the dictionary and you'll see that the English word comes from a Latin word that means something like before birth. Over time, pregnant has picked up other meanings. It can refer, for example, to something that's filled with significance or emotion, a pregnant pause. Now, it's not clear where these other meanings came from. One theory is that a French word that sounded a bit like pregnant became confused with the English word, and so over time, pregnant expanded its meaning. It's a pretty common way for a word to evolve, not planned, just randomly. When we say pregnant, says McWhorter, we can't possibly think of all of its nuances, let alone its original root meaning.
To speak is to use words and expressions in idiomatic ways that float away from their literal meanings to an extent that we don't often have occasion to think about, but it means that reading meaning into the words and expressions that we mouth is often a very dangerous proposition.
Dangerous because we might draw completely false conclusions about a group of people. Are the Chinese, for example, really happier about pregnancy than others? Not in recent decades. China's one-child policy must have resulted in millions of unhappy pregnancies. So what is the connection between how you speak and how you think? You say pregnant, you think happy or burdensome or sick, or maybe you don't think those things at all.
Really, it's just that language and thought don't correspond the way we might think they do when we look at language laid out all neatly on the page.
Over the years, linguists have gone back and forth on how much the language you speak affects how you think. Today, most linguists don't think it does much. But recently, a few studies on how we perceive the likes of cardinal directions and color have concluded that speech does sometimes shape thought. John McWhorter, though, is skeptical. So skeptical that he's written a book called The Language Hoax, Why the World Looks the Same in Any Language. So what, if anything, runs through the minds of Chinese, Chichewa, and Russian speakers when they use their words for pregnant? Here's Wenjing Li again on the two Chinese characters, yo, meaning have, and xi, meaning happiness.
When we say yoshi together, we always think about got pregnant. We don't think about what yo means and what xi means separately.
But does that mean that we should simply ignore the root or literal meanings of words always? Words had to evolve out of some sort of meaning. What about those Chichewa words for pregnant, all meaning sick? Chichewa speaker Ivoni Sundu guesses that the word pakati, meaning literally between life and death, once made a lot of sense.
Most of the women who were pregnant ended up perhaps dying. So that's the reason why our forefathers coined this word, pakati.
Of course, given the random way that words often evolve, they're not exactly the most reliable pieces of historical evidence. But sometimes there may be a glimmer. Sometimes they may just offer a clue about cultural attitudes in the past. Harvard's Svetlana Boym thinks so. There's the Russian word for pregnancy, bereminaya, with its literal meaning of burden. She says Russians, until quite recently, did think of pregnancy as a burden.
Women in old Soviet times were not given painkillers. There was an idea that you're supposed to sort of suffer your burden as a woman, which I think is quite a horrifying idea.
Now, medical practices evolve. So do cultural attitudes. In Russia today, the government is upgrading maternity hospitals and paying couples a cash bonus if they have more than one child. So, is pregnancy still a burden? The word and its root meaning are growing ever farther apart. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox.
Patrick hosts our podcast on language called The World in Words. On the latest edition, he's got an extended conversation with John McWhorter, the linguist you just heard in his story. McWhorter explains why many bilingual people believe they think differently when they switch between languages and why he believes they don't. You can listen to the podcast at PRI.org. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, a Bosnian composer remembers her brother telling her to look inside their record player.
So he said, if you look carefully inside, you would see musician playing. So we had a mariachi LP, so I would look inside of gramophone and I would see mariachis playing because, you know, children, imagination is endless.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. When it comes to climate change, we've been digging ourselves into a very deep hole. That was the message of the first two parts of the latest massive UN report on climate change. Now, the third and final part of the new report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is out, and its conclusion is that we can dig ourselves most of the way back out of that hole if the world acts quickly and decisively. The latest report was released in Berlin over the weekend. Among its 235 authors was Shivan Kartha. He's a senior scientist with the Stockholm Environment Institute's U.S. Center in Somerville, Massachusetts. He describes the UN panel's latest report as hopeful.
I'd say that the sort of the encouraging tone of the report comes from the fact that getting together 200 scientists to review the broad literature and looking across all the sectors where energy is used, buildings, industry, transport, they find that, well, there's no single techno fix, there's no silver bullet, but there is silver birdshot, what we can do in industry, what we can do in buildings, what we can do in transport. And moreover, it is an opportunity for employment. Making efficient things and making them efficiently generally creates more jobs than digging up resources out of the ground and burning them.
Tell me about silver birdshot. What are the key strategies and technologies for getting the world out of this hole?
Well, if we're thinking about energy, one of the things that's happened in the last few years is a lot has been learned about how to make buildings more efficient. And not only a little more efficient, not only, you know, caulking your windows and such, but really a lot more efficient. Carefully and thoughtfully thinking of the whole building as a system. How do the windows interact with the heating system? And how do things vary across the seasons when you need cooling sometimes and heating sometimes? And buildings are now being thought of in a lot, much more sophisticated way with regard to their energy use than they had been thought of. And there are really impressive gains being made, for example, in parts of Europe and in Canada, where building codes are just getting more and more efficient all the time. And that can be translated into other parts of the world where building codes aren't so efficient. In the US, they're not as efficient. In many parts of the developing countries, where most of the cities in which people will be living in another 30 years haven't yet been built up. And those are the kind of lessons that really are can be well translated.
Shivan, what is your own personal take on how realistic it is that we people on planet Earth can do this? Because if you speak with climate activists like Bill McKibben, he kind of believes that nothing short of a wholesale economic reorganization of the planet is what's in order, not just, you know, changing your light bulbs or driving a hybrid.
One of the things that this report really tries to do is convey what the implications are of climate change and dealing with it. We tend to think of the changes we need to make, whether they're changes to our technical systems, changes to our behavior, as sacrifices we'd rather not make. But one of the really important points is that business as usual just isn't an option. Doing nothing just isn't an option. I think that in the near term, there's just so much that can be done on the technical side that'll help us make a really significant start. And those kinds of things tend to have snowballing effects. Right now, we're locked in a system that has a tremendous amount of lock-in, a tremendous amount of institutional, economic, political lock-in. The changes that need to be made, and in particular, the change of using much, much less fossil fuel, which eventually becomes zero fossil fuel, that does indeed involve significant political and economic changes. But as changes start, as things start to shift into a new and sort of transformed economy where there's less reliance on fossil fuel, I think those political forces will also realign. I think the ability of societies to change when it really becomes necessary has been proven to be pretty phenomenal and even inspiring.
Shivan Kartha, senior scientist with the Stockholm Environment Institute's U.S. Center in Somerville, Massachusetts. Thanks very much.
My pleasure, Marco. Thanks for inviting me.
The fight against climate change is, of course, global. But here in the U.S., one of the challenges is to get different communities on board. For example, climate change isn't really an issue that's produced a lot of activism among Latinos. But that's not to say there aren't any Hispanic climate activists. Reporter Patricia Sagastume has more from South Florida.
In Miami, when there's talk of sea level rise, we usually think of this. The Atlantic, beginning to engulf some of the most expensive real estate on the planet. Miami is about 6 feet above sea level and smack up against the ocean. It's one of the cities most economically vulnerable to sea level rise in the world. But it's not just the rich and famous along Florida's Gold Coast who have a lot to lose. Head west in Miami-Dade County and you'll find yourself in booming bedroom communities of mostly Latin immigrants. Many of these are farther away from the sea than Miami itself, but their elevation is actually lower. And it's down there, where the land just about melts right into the sea, that you'll find Celeste de Palma.
actually in the west side of the county is the lowest lying area that we have. And so being here sort of puts it into perspective. You see how wet this area is.
De Palma is an immigrant herself from Argentina. She's also an activist and guide for the Tropical Audubon Society. Today she's leading a tour by kayak in Florida Bay on the edge of Everglades National Park. She wants to show people local wildlife, but also make clear just how vulnerable the area is to sea level rise.
They're starting to look for, you know, where can we buy our house? And of course they want to have the most bang for their buck, right? And so it tends to be in the low-lying areas.
But those areas are also high risk of flooding. That's why De Palma has been working for years to slow the migration of newcomers. Miami-Dade County expects nearly 700,000 new residents by 2030. Many of those will be Hispanics, attracted to the affordable housing. That's where De Palma wants to make a difference.
We have to get the entire population moving. Right now, if you look at it, 65% of this county is from Hispanic descent.
It can be a very tough sell. Climate change can seem like a remote problem, and people tend to have much more immediate concerns, which is why De Palma doesn't stray from her mission wherever she goes.
Okay, guys, are you ready?
Yes!
For what?
Celeste!
In another life, De Palma was a dance instructor, a career she gave up to be an activist. She still fills in occasionally and brings her message on climate change with her in her native Spanish. Today, she's looking for help in stopping development in some especially vulnerable low-lying areas. And she's finding some unexpectedly receptive ears.
We've moved here, but my kids are there. She saw me crying.
Katiuska Ferreira is wary of politics after fleeing strife in Venezuela. But De Palma has won her over.
Of course, I will support her because I trust what she's trying to do. And I didn't know that she was doing this kind of study. I only thought that she was, in the dancing environment.
De Palma herself didn't used to be all that interested in politics or environmental causes.
I didn't used to have that in mind, sea level rise.
On her visit to the Everglades, she tells me she wanted to be a dancer. But that changed on a visit to Peru, when she saw the impact of oil drilling on the environment and local indigenous groups. When she returned to the U.S., she eventually landed a job with the Audubon Society. And she's helped them win at least some small victories where the water meets the rising sea in South Florida. Among other things, De Palma recently helped keep developers from building a new mall near the Glades.
Living in areas where you're going to be more prone to have floods, you are in a unique position to exert pressure onto your elected officials and help us prepare for sea level rise.
Here on the bay, thousands of wading birds are feeding far off in the distance, standing in a foot of water. It's not hard to see the birds as a metaphor for what could lie ahead for people here in South Florida, Hispanic or otherwise. But for De Palma, it's not about standing still, waiting for the inevitable. It's about taking action. For The World, I'm Patricia Sagastume in Miami.
Chile is dealing with its second major emergency in just 2 weeks. On April 2nd, the South American nation was shaken by a big earthquake, which triggered a tsunami warning. Now it's dealing with a massive fire in the coastal city of Valparaiso. At least 12 people have died, and thousands have been forced to evacuate, not knowing if their homes will be there when they get back. The Guardian's Jonathan Franklin is in Santiago, Chile. I asked him if the authorities have any clue as to how the fire started.
There's different theories on how it started. That's very controversial because if it started with a building, then Chilean firefighters are in charge of putting it out. If it started as a brush or forest fire, there's a forest fire brigade. So there's a lot of finger pointing. The firemen are saying it was a structure and the forestry brigade is saying it was trees. But what's clear is that you have a very wooded, very difficult to access ravine where there's both houses and trees. And it's a little behind the city, and that's where it started.
How many people have been affected so far, and do you have a count of actual homes that have been destroyed?
Well, last night, President Michelle Bachelet went on the air and said it was 2,000 homes destroyed. They're saying that's about 8,000 people with no roof and many, many more damage, whether it's smoke or water or partially burned. You can just see scenes of devastation that look like a big bomb went off, and there's entire hillsides are just, you know, shredded.
And this happening in a really picturesque, historic town. Describe Valparaiso to us. What does it look like?
Valparaiso has got kind of the hills of San Francisco with the architecture of San Francisco circa 1906. It's very kind of ramshackle, you know, lots of wooden houses, tin roofs. As you get higher up, it tends to get a little bit poorer. If the closest thing maybe Chile has to a favela, where you have people probably squatting. So it's just ramshackle. And now over the last 20 years, it's been really fixed up and people are really trying to save the historic structures. And so it's got a real dear part in the Chilean history. And before the Panama Canal, this port was one of the most important ones on the entire west coast of South America.
Now, I've read that because of that unique kind of architecture and history, it also makes Valparaiso something of a tough city to manage.
Yeah, the firefighters this morning were explaining that, for example, the higher you get on the hill, the lower the water pressure and the less often you can actually even find a fire hydrant. There's some very deep ravines, so you could be in a fire truck maybe, you know, 50 feet away from the fire, but you can't get anywhere near it because the ravine could go down 30 meters and it's very steep and lots of underbrush. So it's extremely difficult for fighting fires, and it's not even easy to walk in certain places. It's very steep.
I mean, this is a city, safe to say, that Chileans are proud of. Can this area be rebuilt in a way that preserves its historic significance and also makes it a safe place to live?
You know, the million-dollar question here is how can you recreate the charm? Because if you do cookie-cutter houses and get them done quickly, it will look very plastic. And it's a mix between maintaining the authenticity, but also making it safe. There's many people who say that, you know, this is just too dangerous to live, and people are lucky that only 12 died because it really was a fire trap.
Right, and there was also a big earthquake recently, now this fire, all in the space of a couple of weeks. How are Chileans dealing with this?
Chileans have a very good sense of humor when things get tough. I remember I covered the Chilean miner crisis, and it was a sense of humor, even underground, that kept them alive. Last night in my neighborhood, which is in Santiago, about 1,000 people showed up with donations to be sent to Valparaiso. Mm. And this collection spot was only donations for the pets that needed food. So you had 1,000 people showing up with sacks of pet food, and that was just one of many, many instances. I know my own children, excuse me for mentioning them, but you know, they were immediately on Facebook and they organized a huge Easter egg collection so that on Sunday, you know, a couple dozen kids are going to go to Valparaiso and do an Easter egg hunt for all the kids who don't have homes. So it's almost second nature to the Chileans to come out in droves and take care of each other when this happens.
The Guardian newspaper's Jonathan Franklin, who's in Santiago, Chile. Thanks for talking to us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Marco.
Tomorrow marks a one-year anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombings. The city is marking the occasion with a memorial service to honor victims and celebrate survivors. Chris Dobbins is one of the Emerson College students credited with helping launch the Boston Strong movement. One year later, he's still focused on the positive.
There's been so much progress for victims, and there's been so much progress for the community since that day. You see so much pride in the city. It's a beautiful thing.
Tune in tomorrow for a special edition of The World. We'll be broadcasting live from downtown Boston, covering the memorial and the public procession to the marathon finish line afterwards. That's tomorrow, Tuesday, April 15th, here on The World. And check out the blog post from my colleague Jeb Sharp today. As we remember the Boston Marathon tragedy, should we try to forget the alleged bombers? That's at PRI.org. Just ahead, a special Passover Haggadah leads to a special kind of music on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. One kind of Passover music, provided by Bosnian-born composer and accordionist Merima Klucho. Passover begins tonight, and around the world, Jews will refer to the Passover text, or Haggadah, as they sit down to the Seder dinner. This music is actually inspired by one particular Haggadah, a book known as the Sarajevo Haggadah. Today, it's under lock and key in that city, but it was written back in the 14th century, probably in Barcelona, illustrated in brilliant primary colors and gold leaf. This was during the Convivencia, a time when Spanish Jews, Christians, and Muslims lived reportedly in great harmony. But then came the Spanish Inquisition, the expulsion of Jews from Spain, and at that moment also began the long trek of this Haggadah. The book's travels echoed the wandering Jewish population, and the constant threat the book would be destroyed, only to be saved by unlikely non-Jewish characters. This all reflected Jewish hope of survival. The powerful story of the Haggadah was turned into the novel People of the Book in 2008 by former journalist Geraldine Brooks. For composer and accordionist Merima Klucho, a survivor of the Bosnian War, the potency of the story of the Sarajevo Haggadah was inescapable, especially with Sarajevo as the capital of an independent Bosnia.
Sarajevo Haggadah was also and is the symbol of La Convivencia, is the symbol of how you care for the culture that's not your own culture, but it's part of your culture because you live together. That was one fascination for me and a big symbol. And then about 4 years ago, a very good friend of mine gave me a present, which was Geraldine Brooks' People of the Book. And she told me that when she read it, that she actually had to think about me and that she would, that she's really curious, how am I going to feel after reading the book?
Merima Klucho had strong feelings after reading People of the Book. The Geraldine Brooks story that spans centuries and cultures gave Merima concrete ideas for a musical project.
And I started thinking, how would it be to make a journey, musical journey of the Haggadah? And then I also understood where was that metaphor that she found of my life, my own exodus, my own changing of the cultures and interacting with the different cultures, and through that also kind of change.
And what is your own story, Merima, and how does it kind of correspond to this incredible journey this Haggadah took?
So I was 18 when the war started, being born in such a country where you are in love with everybody and with your neighbors and you share your culture, and we really didn't think who is who. And I mean, in that way, we were all together. So at certain point when they started to divide people and say, okay, for example, this part of culture is not yours anymore, this music is not yours anymore, this is ours. So that was very traumatic experience for me. And then, of course, the whole situation, like war, which is a situation on its own. So I was in the war for 2 years. After that, I went to the Netherlands during the war. And I was about 2 years in a kind of refugee camp in the Netherlands. And it took me a while to pick up the normal life and then start to study again. It was the world for me when I was a child, and I had access to all the music from the whole world. Now I can travel and hear it on my own. For example, when I was a child, I had a gramophone, you know, that we would listen to the LPs
on,
record player. And I was 4 and my brother was 6, and he would make me believe that if I look in the little window on the gramophone, which was actually meant when you turn it on, the green light would come on. So he said, if you look carefully inside, you would see musician playing. So we had a mariachi LP, so I would look inside of gramophone and I would see mariachis playing, because, you know, children imagination is endless.
It's a beautiful, beautiful image you create. Yeah,
definitely. So, and now what's really wonderful about my life as a musician, now I travel through all these countries and experience that gramophone, you know, that little window that I could see when I was a child, but now I can experience it and I can be also a musician in that gramophone myself.
Now, in constructing the Sarajevo Haggadah, your musical and multimedia project, you go back centuries raising these styles and idioms that I think a lot of people might not know anything about. I'm wondering if you can, with your accordion, which you brought into the studio, give us a little illustration of the centuries that pass musically and how you kind of reproduce this timeline.
What I use different melodies that I know and that I've learned. I didn't use the melodies, but the motifs. For some of my movements. For example, there is a wonderful Sephardic song, Noches, Noches. So what I did, I took the motif from Noches, Noches.
And this would go back to kind of the first kind of chapter of the story of the Haggadah.
The story of Haggadah, yes.
Back to Spain.
Exactly. And I thought that motif from that song would be beautiful.
So let's hear that motif.
So the motif is... So what I did is I just added and so on, and then I changed the so that I added. So it's so interesting to play with the motifs from these old melodies and then try to create the atmosphere from that time or rhythms that I think that they were used in that time.
It's fascinating that you hear the convivencia in the music. You hear these kind of like North African kind of like little
exactly.
quotes and Sephardic music. It's wild. Composer and accordionist Merima Klucho telling us about the Sarajevo Haggadah and performing it there. And while we're on the subject of Passover, the world's Daniel Estrin has ferreted out some of Jerusalem's secret underground Passover matzah factories. Daniel posted a blog and pictures from one of those factories at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the Trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney-Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund, by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues, the Annenberg Foundation, by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the Ford Foundation, by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org, and the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael V. and Anne Cerisi.
PRI, Public Radio International.